Aureliano II, ashamed, pretended an attack of rage, said that he was misunderstood and abused, and did not visit her again. Petra Cotes, without losing her poise of a wild beast in repose for a single instant, heard the music and the fireworks from the wedding, the wild bustle of the celebration, as if all of it were nothing but some new piece of mischief on the part of Aureliano II. Those who pitied her fate were calmed with a smile. "Don't worry," she told them. "Queens run errands for me." To a neighbor woman who brought her a set of candles so that she could light up the picture of her lost lover with them, she said with an enigmatic security, "The only candle that will make him come is always lighted." Just as she had foreseen, Aureliano II went back to her house as soon as the honeymoon was over. He brought his usual old friends, a traveling photographer, and the gown and ermine cape soiled with blood that Fernanda had worn during the carnival. In the heat of the merriment that broke out that evening, he had Petra Cotes dress up as queen, crowned her absolute and lifetime ruler of Madagascar, and handed out copies of the picture to his friends. She not only went along with the game, but she felt sorry for him inside, thinking that he must have been very frightened to have conceived of that extravagant means of reconciliation. At 7 in the evening, still dressed as the queen, she received him in bed. He had been married scarcely 2 months, but she realized at once that things were not going well in the nuptial bed, and she had the delicious pleasure of vengeance fulfilled. 2 days later, however, when he did not dare return, but sent an intermediary to arrange the terms of the separation, she understood that she was going to need more patience than she had foreseen, because he seemed ready to sacrifice himself for the sake of appearances. Nor did she get upset that time. Once again she made things easy with a submission that confirmed the generalized belief that she was a poor devil, and the only souvenir she kept of Aureliano II was a pair of patent leather boots, which, according to what he himself had said, were the ones he wanted to wear in his coffin. She kept them wrapped in cloth in the bottom of a trunk, and made ready to feed on memories, waiting without despair. "He has to come sooner or later," she told herself, "even if it's just to put on those boots." She did not have to wait as long as she had imagined. Actually, Aureliano II understood from the night of his wedding that he would return to the house of Petra Cotes much sooner than when he would have to put on the patent leather boots. Fernanda was a woman who was lost in the world. She had been born and raised in a city 600 miles away, a gloomy city where on ghostly nights the coaches of the viceroys still rattled through the cobbled streets. 32 belfries tolled a dirge at 6 in the afternoon. In the manor house, which was paved with tomb-like slabs, the sun was never seen. The air had died in the cypresses in the courtyard, in the pale trappings of the bedrooms, in the dripping archways of the garden of perennials. Until puberty, Fernanda had no news of the world except for the melancholy piano lessons taken in some neighboring house by someone who for years and years had the drive not to take a siesta. In the room of her sick mother, green and yellow under the powdery light from the window panes, she would listen to the methodical, stubborn, heartless scales and think that that music was in the world while she was being consumed as she wove funeral wreaths. Her mother, perspiring with 5 o'clock fever, spoke to her of the splendor of the past. When she was a little girl, on one moonlit night, Fernanda saw a beautiful woman dressed in white crossing the garden toward the chapel. What bothered her most about that fleeting vision was that she felt it was exactly like her, as if she had seen herself 20 years in advance. "It was your great-grandmother, the queen," her mother told her during a truce in her coughing. "She died of some bad vapors while she was cutting a string of bulbs." Many years later, when she began to feel she was the equal of her great-grandmother, Fernanda doubted her childhood vision, but her mother scolded her disbelief. "We are immensely rich and powerful," she told her. "One day you will be a queen." She believed it, even though they were sitting at the long table with a linen tablecloth and silver service, to have a cup of watered chocolate and a sweet bun. Until the day of her wedding, she dreamed about a legendary kingdom, in spite of the fact that her father, Don Fernando, had to mortgage the house in order to buy her trousseau. It was not innocence or delusions of grandeur. That was how they had brought her up. Since she had had the use of reason, she remembered having done her duty in a gold pot with the family crest on it. She left the house for the first time at the age of 12 in a coach and horses that had to travel only 2 blocks to take her to the convent. Her classmates were surprised that she sat apart from them in a chair with a very high back, and that she would not even mingle with them during recess.